This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Friday morning sports edition of Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart, and coming up, Suva FC out to make history for Fiji by winning the AFC Champions League final in Port Vila.
We have a lot of Fijian community here. They come all the time and they bring the cover, you know, and they sit around and they told me, if you lose tomorrow, we will kill you. And I said to them, no, we're not here to lose, we're here to win.
Just two chances left for Moana Pacifica to find a Super Rugby win this season. And next up, they're in Fiji.
The brotherhood amongst these players, it runs really deeply. But once they get on the field, fierce competitors. And I know our boys would love nothing more than to get a victory over our draw brothers.
And Manasina Samoa's male head coach ready to stand aside and let the women take over as the side launches their Oceania Championship campaign.
Eventually, us males will bow out, and certainly my objective is to try and build this team to get to Rugby World Cup and then also be prepared to hand the baton over to our women coaches coming through.
More from Ramsey Tomokino on the Oceania Championship and the coaching role at Manasina Samoa later in the program. Well, tomorrow's OFC Champions League final between 10 times champions Auckland City and Fiji's Suva FC has a lot to live up to after two extraordinary semi-finals in Vanuatu. The New Zealanders got out of jail against the host nation's Zephyra Blackbird, coming back from 2-0 down to force extra time and then eventually win the match on penalties. Then Tahiti's AS Pirae also came back from 2-0 down against Suva FC before the Fijian side scored twice more in extra time to seal the win and reached the final for the very first time. The two finalists have already played each other during the group stage of the tournament, with Auckland winning 3-1, but the championship decider is likely to be a very different proposition. And as Talia Olatia reports, if the game is half as compelling as the action served up in the semis, the local fans will lap it up.
Connor Tracy in the Auckland City goal. This is Thomas Mpakaurana. And saved by Tracy. And Auckland City stream to celebrate with the goalkeeper, and it is Auckland City FC who win on penalties 5-4. You have to feel for Thomas Napakaurana. He is inconsolable here. There are Ephira Blackbird players in tears.
The moment that broke the hearts of Ephira Blackbird fans and sent Auckland City into yet another Champions League final. And their coach, Albert Riera, just loved the atmosphere in a packed VFF stadium in Port Vila.
With a lot of good football, with goals, with drama, with penalty shootout, you couldn't really ask for anything else. And they showed their appreciation at the end. And it's fantastic to see. It's these games that you want to be part of as a player. And it would be nice to see that as well in New Zealand, where really we don't have these big crowds. It's not the first time I see this type of crowd in the islands. They love football. They embrace it. They breathe football in every corner of the country, and everyone is very kind to us. And so far, it's been a fantastic tournament.
Auckland were in big trouble until the cavalry arrived in the form of substitute Ryan DeVries, who scored both his team's goals to give them a lifeline.
Allison swings it in, and it's in the back of the net, and it's Ryan DeVries.
It was a decent ball that came in. In fact, a number of Ephira players just allowing DeVries, the substitute, to head that on.
They're queuing up at the back post. The keeper's dropped it. And DeVries has put it in the back of the net. Oh, Andreas Dusch, head and hands. And it's DeVries who equalises deep in stoppage time.
Look, we probably needed a change of tempo, and this is a big tournament for us, not just players, but as a club. And we knew what was on the line, and I just tried to do my best and give whatever I can to the team. And
if you're sitting in the stands and you paid good money to watch a game, that's entertainment to the death.
And when it came to the penalty shootout, DeVries says he has nothing but admiration for the players who did the job for Auckland.
We sort of gathered before the penalty shootout and we said, boys, whoever wants it, put your hand up and go and do the job. And the boys that stood up, credit to them. I mean, it's difficult, especially in semifinals where everything rides on a penalty shootout. You know, it just shows the character in the team. Teams in the islands,
they're getting better and better every year. And Ifiru was probably one of the better ones that we've had in a long time. And to make another final, it's a chance for us to make history again. It's something the boys have worked hard for. So the boys are definitely going to be up for it.
Opponents Suva FC will go into the final as underdogs, having already lost to the New Zealand outfit on match day 3. But coach Maxwell Faggard is hoping that beaten semi-finalist Ifiru can provide a few pointers on how to rattle the favourites this time.
We will go back and assess their video and what sort of approach they took, you know, maybe learn something off that. They're technically very strong, you know, they like to stay with the ball, you know, and when we played them last time, we gave them too much respect, you know, and football is not supposed to be played like that. Second half, we came back and we were like pressing at the right time and winning the ball, and we kept them on the back foot.
So that's Suva's strategy, but how do Auckland plan to approach a game which most observers would expect them to win? Coach Riera says the nature of their win over Ifiru was a huge psychological boost.
Only good thing about playing a team that you have already played is that you already studied that rival before, so you have pretty much all the info that you need. But the reality is that in one off game, especially in the final, with the pressure kicks in, it's all a different story. So, yeah, we played them before, but they also know us very well. So it's a completely different game. But having the result that we had, the way we did it, always give you that extra boost of believing that everything is possible. And the learning point is that you never lose belief.
Finals are always different. When you play group stages, there's not as much pressure because you've got games to sort of make up if something goes wrong. Where a final, it's a big occasion. And I think the big thing is we need the boys to focus, and big players will step up for big games. But these are the things you prepare for as a player, you know, all the hard work, all the training, these special games.
Sometimes makes or breaks a career.
Suva are hoping to lift their nation. They're out to do what no Fijian team has done before, win the Champions League and secure a place at the FIFA Club World Cup.
Fijian football had made a step back. You know, now we have put the Fijian football on the map, and we kind of strong in the Pacific. You know, we can compete and play with good teams. We're working hard and doing development back at home. You know, the Fiji FA is behind it. You know, they're spending a lot of money educating coaches. You know, we want educated coaches to take on the children. And I have like 111 kids from 5 to 15. And the age group, you know, and pushing for girls and boys. And we're trying to push and teach them the right things.
And Suva will be hoping to have the local crowd on their side, particularly with two Niue Vanuatu players in their ranks, Alex Samuel and the man who turned the semi-final against Pirae, Azaria Soromon.
Soromon's moving.
That's a great run from Soromon, Azaria Soromon. And he's come up with the ball and he rolls it home into an empty net to send this local crowd into raptures.
When you have support like that, we call it the Torf player, an awesome crowd. You know, the place we played our pool games, they made us really feel at home, you know. And likewise here at Port Vila. And we have a lot of Fijian community here. They come all the time and they bring the cover, you know, and they sit around and they told me, if you lose tomorrow, we will kill you. And I said to them, and I said, no, we're not here to lose. We're here to win.
They certainly are. Maxwell Faggard, coach of Suva FC, out to upset the odds, you would think, in the OFC Champions League final against perennial winners Auckland City. That game kicks off at 2 p.m. local time in Port Vila tomorrow afternoon. And our reporter there was Talia Olatia. Now, while Auckland City focus on Suva and the Champions League final, Ifiru Blackbird will no doubt be reflecting on what might have been. Few people expected them to win their semi-final against the New Zealand team, but boy, they so very nearly did. And the General Secretary of the Vanuatu Football Federation, Albert Manaroto, says they were inspired by a pre-match address from their national captain and now A-League grand finalist with Central Coast Mariners, Brian Kaltak.
I think he was basically encouraging them to, you know, to do their best, because this is the first time the team has played. But I think it has helped a lot. The team did well, which was really good for them. But I think Brian's input, just as the national captain, most of the players in the team were in the national team players also. So I think it was so important for him, and as the impact as a captain, to be seen to be encouraging the players.
His chat must have really inspired the players.
Yeah, I believe so. It's so important because the team, this is the first time the team was played in the Champions League and has gone up as far as semi-finals. And I think his input was so important for the team. because of who he is, who Brian Kaltak is, and coming from him, having made that level and being covered widely, says a lot to the players.
And how much does he inspire young kids growing up playing soccer in Vanuatu now that they can see him on the TV and doing this on the big stage?
He's on the social media every day. Everything he says, every clips, every video clips he has spoken on is widely circulated in the social media, so he's very popular. Again, you know, it would be different watching it from a clip, but I'm sure if he is here and if he's seen publicly here in Vanuatu and he presents him to the public, I think it'll be a very more, there'll be more reactive, more reaction to his, you know, to actually seeing him in person and to him speaking to the kids here.
Albert Manarotto, General Secretary of the Vanuatu Football Federation, speaking there to Kyle Evans. As for Brian Kaltak, the A-League Grand Final to come for him next weekend. And if his team Central Coast Mariners were to win, I'm pretty sure Brian Kaltak will be going on a tour of Vanuatu with his winner's medal. We'll have more on the build-up to that game next Friday morning here on Pacific Beat. Now, on a less positive note, Samoa's representatives at the OFC Champions League, Lupe Ole Sawanga, are considering opting out of the tournament in future because of rising costs and opaque regulations. The Samoan side arrived in Port Vila with a large slice of their original squad from the qualifying round missing because of OFC transfer rules. Lupe's manager, Lai Tatianga, insists that those rules have been interpreted differently in the past, and while his club were forced to leave players out, other teams were allowed to fly in reinforcements. Tatianga says he asked OFC for leniency, but there was none forthcoming. To make matters worse, after two games, the Samoans ran out of fit players, and in the words of an OFC statement, were withdrawn from OFC Champions League 2023 and have been referred to the OFC Disciplinary and Ethics Committee. Unable to get a flight home at that point, the team decamped to Port Vila, where Tatianga says they had to rely on the generosity of the local Samoan association to cover their accommodation for three nights.
It's a tough situation for us, given we weren't at this thought that it will happen, but we were trying to manage the team on the resources that we have. So that's why with the group that we brought over, we know they are the really young ones, but we have to stuck with it. And on this issue, I had a video call with the OFC before we come.
And how did that call go? Were they sympathetic?
They said that our matter has to be referred to the disciplinary committee. I know that it's a very high-level tournament, but Lupe Sawanga is the only amateur club in it. And in accessing anything within OFC, it costs us to relay anything to them. We have to pay a bond. And in our preparation coming over, I was thinking of withdrawing the club from this tournament. But I had a look at the regulations, and if I withdraw the club prior to the tournament starts, then the club has to pay $40,000 as penalty.
You're now in a situation where you did go over to Vanuatu, you did compete with a weakened squad, and then in the end you were told that you were considered to have withdrawn from the competition because you ran out of fit players, and now you're facing an investigation by the OFC's Disciplinary and Ethics Committee. So, I mean, you could yet be fined anyway, couldn't you?
Yeah, actually, under the regulations, it's clearly saying that if we withdraw after the tournament starts, there will be consequences of our actions, and we understand, but we win our out of our way, trying to make sure that we provide all the valid reasons for us to not participating in the final game. We didn't want to break any rules. We wanted to make sure that with our actions, we know that under the regulations, we might be banned from the tournament for the next O-League. And we don't know how long we're going to ban us. But there was nothing there to at least acknowledge that we have reasons not to play our last match.
But to an outsider, if you were to be banned from next season's tournament, that would seem to be extraordinarily harsh, because the reason you couldn't play was because you had an understrength squad, because you were sticking to the rules, and then you lost a number of those players to injury, and those injuries were confirmed by an independent doctor. I'm wondering quite what else you could have done.
Exactly. To be honest, I think this will be our last O-League. With the tournament organizing committee, in the past few years, they were paying for accommodations for all the clubs. But now those will be the cost for the club to bear. And for us as an amateur, a club has to do a bank loan just to make sure that we brought over a team, to make sure that we weren't paying a hefty fine of 40 grand. So in both ways, withdrawing before the tournament and withdrawing after the tournament, we still get penalised.
Are you in a position to fight this? I mean, clearly at the moment, the investigation by the Disciplinary and Ethics Committee hasn't taken place. We don't know what they're going to come up with, but it doesn't look good for you, does it?
With everything to go through OFC, there's always a sum of money we have to pay. Like, if any disputes, we have to pay like 500 New Zealand dollars. And our club, we're self-funded by our locals and the management. So we don't have that in financial terms.
So as far as the club is concerned right now, you don't want anything more to do with the OFC Champions League. You feel you've had too rough a ride. It's just not worth the trouble next time.
Well, we take the positives out of it. We've seen a huge improvement from our boys in the past years. And the exposure to this high level of football, we gesture that, we acknowledge that. But in terms of financing this tournament, I don't think it's doable for a club like us to participate in this tournament anymore.
So are you saying that with or without the regulations that have caused the problems for you, that you have effectively being priced out of the competition for the future?
Yes, it's a costly activity now. And we were trying to argue with OFC on some of the issues, like transiting and extra days for us to stay in Vanuatu. But for me as team manager, we can't wait to reach our shores and rethink things through with the O-League.
So I presume you're going to have to sit down and talk to your own federation back in Samoa about this before any decision is taken as to whether, assuming you're champions next time in Samoa, that you compete, or whether any other Samoan team competes in future in the Champions League.
Yeah, I'm pretty much sure federation in Samoa will address this issue as well. It's unfortunate for us not doing well in this tournament, but we feel that with the experience that we brought over, we carried away in our first game, but we were able to get some firepower in the game against Solomon Warriors. But it's unfortunate that our players got injury and not available for our final game. But we were trying to rethink things about development of our own club. But hopefully we might not get penalised also in our federation as well.
La'i Tatianga, Alupe Ole Sawanga's a team manager and very clearly more than a little disillusioned with OFC regulations and the Champions League. And Carl Evans is holding the front page for us, as usual, here on Pacific Beat. Good morning to you, Carl.
Good morning to you, Richard.
Super Typhoon Mawa has set a new course away from Guam. So is that good news?
I think they'll be taking that as good news. It has intensified again into a super typhoon. It is now heading towards the Philippines and Taiwan. So this is according to the State Weather Service, who was quoted in The Independent about an hour ago. It's still packing winds of up to 230 kilometres per hour as it tracks northwestward. Strong winds still persist on Guam as well, and residents have been urged to stay home until conditions improve. However, in some good news, a typhoon warning for the island was officially lifted at 5 p.m. yesterday. So I imagine there's probably a few people who are braving the outdoors and walking around outside at the moment.
And therefore, I presume we're getting some sort of picture now of the damage that's been caused by the storm. What do we know?
Yeah, that's right. So luckily, Governor Lou Guerrero, she told CNN that no deaths have been reported at this stage, and there are no significant injuries really either. However, power and water supply have been very badly disrupted. According to the Guam Power Authority, only 1,000 of its approximate 52,000 customers still have power. The Guam Memorial Hospital is operating on a standby generator. Meanwhile, Guam Water Works Authority said there is no estimate for when water will be restored. And if you can jump onto some of those local news websites like the Guam Daily Post, there's some truly breathtaking photos of just what the island looks like following that typhoon.
Yes, no joy to be had, generally, after an event like that. Now, pro-independence leader Oscar Temeru has been acquitted in a funding case in French Polynesia. Is that right?
That's right. So he and two others have been acquitted by the appeal court over charges they were funding a radio station. So this is reported by RNZ, and it comes after Temeru was given a six-month suspended prison sentence back in 2019 and also fined $50,000 after the criminal court found he had funded a Radio Tofana to benefit his Tavini Hurriatira party. There was a belief at the time that the radio station had regularly opposed France's nuclear weapons tests in the region, but the defence said no recording had ever been produced to prove it was propaganda. Therefore, Temeru's lawyer said he'd been accused of something he never did and had since that had since been established. Meanwhile, the chairs of the board of the association which runs that station, they've also been acquitted. They'd initially been slapped with a one-month and three-month suspended prison sentence. And the station itself will no longer have to pay a $1 million fine. That's been thrown out as well. So, yeah, I imagine there's a few size of relief to be had over there.
Now, unfortunately, sport and politics are never too far apart. And in Tonga, the opposition there are demanding to know how much money the country paid in compensation, this after they bailed out of hosting the Pacific Games back in 2019. So what can you tell us?
Yeah, so this is reported by the Matangi Tongan newspaper. And as you would know, yeah, Tonga was awarded the Games back in 2012, but pulled out in 2017, citing financial concerns. That prompted legal action against the country's government in 2018 by the Pacific Games Council and the Tonga National Olympic Committee, which demanded millions of dollars in damages for a breach of contract. That was settled last year confidentially, but now the issue has been raised in the country's parliament with the opposition asking for those figures to be revealed. They want to know why it wasn't mentioned in the annual report. They also want to know what legislation was used to withhold it.
So the Prime Minister, how has he dealt with those questions?
He did address them, only saying that the country's Supreme Court had ruled out that the settlement was confidential. Sorry, the Supreme Court had ruled that the settlement was confidential, and if they wanted to dig it up, it would have to go through the courts. Parliament was also told that as the annual report had already been approved, it could not be debated on again either. So might not get the answers they were hoping for, it looks like.
No, and that's a long-running saga and clearly still, surprisingly, not over. Carl, thanks very much indeed for the update. And we stay with the news of the day because Japan is trying frantically to shore up diplomatic support before it starts to release treated wastewater from the crippled Fukushima nuclear power plant into the ocean. The discharge is expected to start sometime in the next few months, but as North Asia correspondent James Oaten reports, there are still grave concerns about the environmental impact on the Blue Pacific, this despite assurances from Fukushima's operators and the Japanese government.
The Bougainville capital, Buka, may be more than 5,000 kilometres from Fukushima, but people are worried about what's about to happen in Japan. Ignatius Wama is a local fisherman.
We need to tell the Japanese government to put a stop on this. We don't want this to happen in the Pacific Ocean.
12 years ago, a tsunami destroyed the Fukushima nuclear power plant, leading to nuclear meltdowns. The plant's operators, TEPCO, have had to pump water to cool the highly radioactive melted fuel and fuel debris. Now there's 1.3 million tonnes of treated wastewater sitting in huge tanks, and TEPCO is running out of room. So it's preparing to start discharging treated water, and there's concern ocean currents could spread it for thousands of kilometres.
We are in this area where we sell fish daily, and people feed on fish daily. If the sea is damaged by this nuclear waste, it will affect us a lot.
A highly specialised filtration system removes contaminants before its plant release. What it can't remove is a radioactive form of hydrogen called tritium. But Jim Smith, a professor in environmental science from the University of Portsmouth in the UK, says the discharged water would be diluted to safe levels.
So we measure radioactivity amounts in becquerels. The planned release will be at a level of about 1,500 becquerels per litre of tritium. And that 1,500 becquerels per litre is about seven times lower than the World Health Organization drinking water standard. So in theory, if it wasn't salty water and all the rest of it, you could drink it.
He says releasing the water is safer than keeping it stored, where it would be under threat from typhoons, earthquakes and tsunamis.
The Le Hague facility in France discharges about 450 times more tritium every year than this planned release from Fukushima. Sellafield in the UK discharges about 45 times more to the Irish Sea. And so we know quite a lot about how tritium accumulates in the marine system. And we know that if it's discharged in this tritiated water form, then it doesn't biomagnify. So that means that the amount in an organism is the same as the amount in the water.
To calm concerns, South Korean officials have been given an unprecedented six-day tour of the Fukushima plant this week. Japan is also courting Pacific Island leaders after the Secretariat of the Pacific Islands Forum criticised the planned discharge earlier this year. Mark Brown is the Cook Islands Prime Minister and now chair of the Pacific Islands Forum. He says he's happy with the level of transparency from Japan.
This water is going to be discharged first and foremost closest to Japan. Japan has assured us that they would not do anything that would see their food chain or the biodiversity being affected by this water.
Solomon Islands have reportedly rebuked an offer from Japan to boost maritime security due to concerns about the discharge, while Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister James Marape refused to disclose his position when approached by the ABC. Cook Islands Prime Minister Mark Brown says Pacific leaders will be in a better position to respond after a report from the International Atomic Energy Agency.
But I'm sure there is unity across all of our Pacific countries that we don't want anything that will damage our ocean. The verification around that, we'll await the report that comes out in June. But I'm sure that when that does come out, we'll be in a better position to respond.
Cook Islands Prime Minister Mark Brown ending that report from North Asia correspondent James Oaten, with additional reporting in PNG by our correspondent Tim Swanston. You're with Pacific Beats for a Friday morning here on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart, and we return now to sporting matters, and the search for a new coach has begun at Moana Pacifica. This after Aaron Major, who will have led the side through their first 2 years of Super Rugby Pacific, announced his intention to stand down so he can spend more time with his family. But Major's departure is the least of Moana's worries as they stare down the barrel of a winless season with just two more matches to go. There are also question marks over their continued use of Mount Smart Stadium in South Auckland as their home base, with attendances barely into four figures on occasions. And arguably their best player, Levi Amoa, is all set to leave for the Crusaders. But despite all the doom and gloom, Moana's chief executive, Palanato Sakalia, is far from downhearted. He denies that relations have broken down between Aaron Major and his players, and he sees no reason why that elusive first win can't be achieved this weekend in Fiji.
The boys would love nothing more than to get a victory against draw on their home nations. You know, the brotherhood amongst these players, you know, the Pacific brothers, it runs really deeply. But once they get on the field, fierce competitors. And I know our boys would love nothing more than to get a victory over our draw brothers.
But of course, they're travelling to Fiji on the back of a difficult week with your coach, Aaron Major, announcing that he will stand down at the end of this season. And by all accounts, it's not exactly harmonious in the dressing room there at the moment. So, I mean, that's going to make it very hard, isn't it, for the players to go out and lift themselves and win a game?
The players are in really good spirits. I'm so proud of the players, of our coaches and the rugby organisation. You know, it's been a tough season, there's no doubt about it, but their spirits, I saw them the other day when they were training, their spirits were high, the engagement was good, the interaction between the players and the coaches, the spirits are really good. There's no doubt that the news of our coach Aaron Major stepping aside, resigning due to family reasons, you know, that's really understandable. It's been a really tough job for him. He's given his heart and soul to the club over the last couple of years, and you know, not having his family here, it's really taken a toll. So we're totally understanding of his decision, and rightly so. We back him 100% to do what's right by him and his family.
You could understand why he would want to do something on that basis, but the suggestion suggestion that's been put to me is perhaps there is a bit of a rift between him and the players.
No, there's no rift between the players and the coaches. You know, the relationships are really strong. They're getting on with the job. They acknowledge that they haven't been getting the results that they wanted. But, you know, each Monday they get together, they do their reset, they bond, they get into the training and get into the week. Their spirits are still really high.
And what about the wider future for Moana Pacifica at the end of what will have been a very tough season for you? Clearly, we hope that you may get that elusive win, maybe two, with the two games that are left. But looking ahead to next year and beyond, what are the changes that perhaps need to be made to the structure of the club? And for one thing, will you continue to play at Man Smart? Is that going to be viable for you?
The first thing is, when we started our journey as a club, what people have got to appreciate is, when you look at Drua is a club, while they've been in Super now for the same time period as us, 2 years, but as an organisation, they've spent, 3 years in the Australia competition? So in total, they've been operating for 5 years. We had to stand up, not just a team, but stand up a whole new organisation, whole new club in the middle of the pandemic last year. So it's really hard to say that we are 2 years into establishing a club when one of those years was just so disrupted by COVID. When we started the rugby campaign, we always worked on the basis that it was going to take 3 to 4 years to set really good, solid foundations. And those foundations includes putting in place your systems, your processes, your structures, getting your program up and running, recruiting a baseline of players, refreshing those players, you know, your roster over a couple of years, you know, bringing people in to kind of build that up. So our goal was, over that 3 to 4 year period, is making sure that we systematically put the fundamentals in place, uplift the players, build their conditioning, build their abilities, make sure that we as a club are well functioning. It's the things that you don't see. It's the things off the field that have been really important for us. And that's where I really want to give credit to Aaron Major, the work that he and his team have done to put in good place, good systems, good processes, the conditioning, teaching our players professional habits, you know, because a significant number of these players have never been in professional rugby before. They've never been in professional programs. So being able to teach them those basics, get them used to it, lift their conditioning levels, that's been really important. So I'd like to think that come year 3 and year 4, we will start to see the benefits of what we've been building as an organisation, that you'll start to see the benefits of what's been invested into the players to lift their conditioning, to lift their abilities in terms of the technical and the tactical aspects of the game. We should, you know, we'd expect that would really start to come through in years 3 and 4.
And when it comes to appointing a new coach, will that person have to be of a Pacifica background or not?
What's most important for us as an organisation is that the head coach or any leader within our organisation, that they have what I call that cultural competence, that cultural authenticity, and that cultural status. Those key characteristics are really important, you know. So, yep, ideally it's a Pacific person, but equally there are some amazing coaches out there of European descent that have got great status amongst our Pacific players. So I think for us as an organisation, we are remaining open-minded, but are being uncompromising about what we're looking for in terms of that cultural authenticity and competence.
Renato Sakalia, Chief Executive of Moana Pacifica, and he'll be there to see his team take on the Fijian Undrua in front of a big and, I suspect, rather partisan crowd at Churchill Park in La Toca tomorrow with the kickoff at 2 p.m. local time. And no doubt the Undrua will be going flat out for a win that would increase their prospects of making the Super Rugby finals. Meanwhile, in Rugby League and the Queensland Cup, the PNG Hunters, they're back in Port Moresby to take on the Pride from Cairns tomorrow at 3 p.m. local time. And in the Ron Massey Cup, the Kaiviti Silktails, they're at home in Nandi on this occasion to play the Penrith Brothers tomorrow evening. Now, based on recent history, Fijiana will start as hot favourites to win the Oceania Women's Rugby Championship when they kick off on the Gold Coast later today, with Manosina Samoa probably rated most likely to claim second place ahead of Fuifui Lupe Tonga and the PNG Cassowaries. The Manosina side will be made up of players from Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, and there is a local contingent from Samoa. A number of the players are products from the groundbreaking World Rugby Combine last year that featured the best in talent from Samoa, Tonga and Papua New Guinea, and several of those players were contracted by Super W franchises for the season just gone. Right now, Ramsey Tomokino, who was appointed back in 2018, is still Manosina's head coach, but his support staff are largely female, and he's planning to step back in the not-too-distant future and let them take over, which means that assistant Filoa Enolico, who has just finished an internship with the Brumbies in Super W, would appear to be Coach Tomokino's most likely successor.
Filo is definitely involved with us, being the academy manager for Lakapi Samoa as well. And, you know, she's just building her profile as a coach and, you know, gaining that experience, being involved with the Brumbies, which from my understanding, she thoroughly enjoyed her time there. And she's equally happy to be back involved in the Manosina campaign. But, you know, natural progression. Eventually, us males will bow out and, you know, we've got our female coaches that will be able to step up and take over. And that's probably how it should be. Certainly, my objective is to try and build this team to get to Rugby World Cup and then also be prepared to hand the baton over to our women coaches coming through.
Is that a strategy being employed by Lakapi Samoa, or are the other unions in Oceania, and particularly the three involved here, Fiji, Papua New Guinea, Tonga, are they going down a similar road?
Well, Rugby World Cup in New Zealand last year, there was some workshops, and there is a strategy that's talked about by the next Rugby World Cup. 40% of your management team should be female. And in terms of us in Samoa, we've certainly smashed that already. For me, that was simply a no-brainer. We've got Filoi, Denise Tia, who's our team manager, Cynthia Ta'ala, Timolo, who's assistant coach, and Levasa Bakalic, who's our physio, former Manusina players that are part of this management group. And, you know, and that's where it should land. That's where it should lie. You know, we should have, much like you see in the men's space, maybe out of crystal ball and could see into the future that's the way it was going to go. But certainly that's always been my intent. I'm only a custodian, and if I can walk away and we've got former Manusina players looking after Manusina.
All the elements it would seem to me are there for Manosina to make an impact on this championship. The one thing you've been missing in recent times is competitive action, and that's the one thing the Fijians have had plenty of. So that's the real gap, isn't it, that you and the other two teams have to make up against them?
Yeah, absolutely. There's potential, you know, obviously the combine allows PNG, Samoa and Tonga players to have an opportunity to get into Super W and be exposed to that next level. In terms of my role at Moana Pacifica, there is definitely plans to have a Moana Pacifica women's program, and that can serve both Tonga and Samoa well. And hopefully, if we're not involved in Opiki Rugby, which is the New Zealand Super Women's competition, then certainly there are talks, and it's still all at talk stage, and there's a lot of moving parts, that Moana Pacifica team could be part of Super W. Initial kind of plan is that they might play some games next year against the Super W teams, but with a view to being immersed into the competition in 2025. That will certainly close the gap, and then the opportunity to play in the World 15 competitions, which is what's on the line for the Four Nations competing this week.
So you talked there about qualifying for the World Rugby W15 global competition, which is due to start in October. And if I understand it correctly, there's essentially three tiers to this competition. So in terms of the two teams that will qualify from Oceania, how will those two teams fit into this new world competition?
So the winner of Oceania will land into Tier 2, and that competition will be played in South Africa in October. And the runner-up in Oceania will end up going to the Tier 3 competition, which will be in Hong Kong. So it'll be massive for us as a Samoan team, because even though we're getting more and more players opting to put their hand up to wear blue, there's still a great portion of players out there that are still sitting on the fence and, you know, hoping that they get the call up for the Black Ferns and that. But I think once people actually start to realise, oh, well, look, Samoa's playing in South Africa or Hong Kong or whatever, and then, you know, there'll be Oceania again next year, and then there'll be World 15 again in October, and that'll be in another different venue. If you're a young rugby player and aspiring to play rugby and travel and do all those cool things that rugby players get to do, that will, you know, make a lot more players realise, oh, geez, you know, I can just get the same travel opportunities as someone in the Black Ferns or the Wallaroos.
There's a lot happening in the women's game, both within the region and around the world. Do you get the sense, as I think has been expressed to me more than once in the world of soccer, that the women's teams in the Pacific could advance more quickly and higher up the ladder than the men's teams, simply because of the nature of the game and these world competitions now that are becoming available to them?
Yeah, potentially. Absolutely. There's a great number of Pacific players that make up a lot of the teams, you know, the FPC teams and also even the Super W teams. You know, they're getting more and more, and you know, and obviously if some of those ladies all decide now, look, hey, we want to represent our Pacific nation, our heritage, then certainly I expect that there'll be massive growth and improvement. And I think even this Oceania tournament will also be a lot tougher than before, because you know, Tonga's got, they've got a different profile of their team. They've got players out of the USA and Australia. I think they've only got two out of NZ, and again a small number out of Tonga. And PG, from my understanding, have a number of players from rugby league here in Australia and in PG. So it's going to be, the competition is not going to be easy. It's going to be tough, and we've got to be on our game. But certainly, yeah, I believe that more competition and more games that are outlined for the women's, yeah, there is certainly an opportunity for us to forge ahead a lot quicker than the men.
Ramsey Tomokino, head coach for Manosina Samoa, and their opening match in the Oceania Championship is against Fuifui led by Tonga on the Gold Coast this evening. But first up, it will be Fijiana up against the PNG Cassowaries. Now, a little earlier in the program, we heard from Palinato Sakalia, the CEO of Moana Pacifica, who was putting a brave face on in the midst of the club's current crisis. No wins, soon no coach, and maybe no place to go with pitiful attendances at their home ground in South Auckland. Now, you might expect Moana's chief executive to put a positive spin on her bleak situation, but just how bad is the crisis at the Super Rugby Pacific franchise, really? I put that question to New Zealand Herald rugby writer Gregor Paul, who follows the Pacific rugby scene closely. And to put matters in perspective, he says you have to go back to the point when Moana Pacifica came into being.
When we go back to the formation of Moana, when they were initially granted a license, which was a massive breakthrough moment for Pacifica to get to that point. New Zealand Rugby owned the license and said, great, we're going to have this team. And look, what they really did was they said, here's a license, you guys off you go and start a rugby team in South Auckland, which is about, I don't know, 20-minute drive from where the Blues play, who are quite a strongly Pacifica team, and about an hour away from where the Chiefs are. Again, a team with its own identity and culture. And there was also worry that there was not going to be a fan base for Moana in South Auckland, that they were going to be competing for sponsors and fans. And thirdly, the really big worry was, how do we manage the trafficking of players between all these clubs? Because there are plenty of players in the Blues and the Chiefs, and in fact all around New Zealand, who are Samoan and Tongan eligible, but are currently playing for the Blues and one of the other teams. So what's going to be the process around contracting talent, retaining talent, and making sure that not everybody goes after the same guys? All those questions are coming to light now for various reasons, and there needs to be some management of and some refereeing of the process around how Moana go around getting the players and who it is that they're actually wanting to represent and who they want to put on their books. That's problem one. Problem two, and I think it's going to resolve itself anyway, is playing in South Auckland hasn't worked out for them, and it's exceptionally expensive to be playing at Mount Smart Stadium where they are. So they're going to be looking to go on the road next year, take themselves around the country, which may or may not work in terms of building a fan base, but it will probably reduce the amount of money they're having to spend just to host games. And then thirdly, they're going to need a new coach, but I think that will be the easiest problem for them to solve.
You say go on the road around New Zealand, but what about more games in the islands? They played in Samoa once this season, and the CEO has said that their long-term aim is to play all their home games either in Samoa or Tonga.
Yeah, I think they're planning on playing at least two in Samoa and Tonga. But look, you haven't asked the question, but I'll kind of ask it and answer it for you, is that there's one of the issues that's been developing here is everybody looks at the Fijian Drua and the success that they've had this year, and particularly when they've been playing in Fiji. They've been great. They've got massive support, very difficult to beat over there. And everybody's wondering why that can't be replicated by Moana. Well, we have to be reasonable here and understand that the economics of Fiji and the population base of Fiji is significantly greater than it is in Samoa and Tonga. And we saw when the Moana went over to play in Apia, I don't think they got a huge crowd. And so there are issues about playing over there around ticket pricing, how many people can actually afford to come and play them, are the economics of playing in Apia or Nuku'alofa viable? That's a really difficult question, and everybody needs to stop comparing Fiji with Samoa and Tonga, because they're really not at the same stage of economic development with the same basis of population. So just plonking a team in Apia may not be the answer long term. It might be. And that is ultimately the really big question. Is it viable for this team to be based in the islands, or are they going to have to continue to be based in New Zealand? And if so, where in New Zealand can they play? Because while South Auckland is the sort of a Polynesian stronghold of the country, it's right in the same market as the Blues and really in the same market as the Chiefs, and it hasn't worked putting them there. It's a really tough question to know where Moana should be based.
So they're coming to the end of their second season. That they've got a couple of matches to go, the first of which is against the Ndrua in Fiji. So there's a very strong likelihood that they're going to end up with no wins at all this season, plus all the other problems that you've outlined. How long have they got? How long will the powers that be give them to survive and prove that they're a viable franchise?
Well, I hope indefinitely. I think you've got to make a long-term commitment, and I believe that is what has been made to Moana, because they need to remain part of this competition for all the reasons that were put forward when they initially came in. They are a team which is designed in intent to identify and nurture Pacifica talent, particularly Samoan and Tonga, either from guys who are currently playing in Europe or Japan, or bringing guys who are growing up in Samoa and Tonga, or guys here in New Zealand and Australia, but bringing them all together under one roof, under one brand, that creates an environment that's right for those players, develops them to the point where they are regularly producing guys who can play international rugby for Samoa and or Tonga. And the idea there then is that we strengthen the international game, that they're ready to play at the highest level when that time comes around. So that basis of why they exist is really, really important. If they cease to exist, Moana I'm talking about, what is the future look like for Samoa and Tonga as international teams? We're going to be stuck where we've always been, that these guys don't have any games, they don't have any development structure, and they don't have any ability to get their hands on the players that they should be getting their hands on. And more dual eligible players will be committing to play for New Zealand and Australia, and indeed England, Wales, France, wherever else Pacifica players are turning up at the moment. So the answer to the question is this needs to be an indefinite project, and it needs to go on until they get these problems fixed. So I hope that everyone will sit around a table and work out what the solutions are, rather than to have a conversation about, well, this isn't working, maybe we need to shut them down, because that would be a terrible blow for the game in the islands.
So against that background, we're told that there are talks going on at the moment, discussions, call them what you will, that may lead to the Flying Fijians and Japan joining the current four nations in the Rugby Championship. It will become a six-nation competition. That would be great for Fiji, clearly, but would that be good or bad news for Tonga and Samoa?
It probably wouldn't affect Tonga and Samoa, to be honest. The two questions are separate. I probably need to say at the moment, the conversations about Fiji and Japan aren't necessarily about rugby championship. They are about those two teams entering what's going to be called the Nations Championship, which will be the sort of 12-team global tournament. I think in time, and what does in time mean, I don't know, that yes, the current rugby championship nations would like to bring Fiji and Japan into that tournament when they've got a bit of belief that they're ready to do so. Where does it leave Samoa and Tonga? Well, it doesn't cut them out of the picture necessarily. It just sort of begs the question, which we're having to ask anyway, is what kind of international competition can be built for Samoa and Tonga, and for the teams that aren't quite ready to play in the Six Nations or play in the rugby championship? That's what we need to get an answer to. Now, fixing up Fiji doesn't mean that you're leaving Samoa and Tonga behind. It just creates that same question that needs to be answered. Is there going to be a kind of second tier tournament for these guys to get regular test rugby, and then with a view that in time there's either expansion or rugby championship, or there's promotion and relegation, or whatever it's going to be? But right now, that's a question that can be asked concurrently along with Fiji and Japan. What is the future for Samoa and Tonga?
Forthright as ever, Gregor Paul, rugby writer with the New Zealand Herald. And that's just about it from Pacific Beat and this sporting edition for a Friday here on ABC Radio Australia, except to mention maybe an interesting little tale boiling up over in England with the Barbarians due to take on a World 15 in a rugby encounter this weekend. Some interesting Pacific names in the World 15. Charles Pietau, the million-pound man, is there representing Tonga. Also there, Semi Randrandra and a World Cup Sevens winner with Fiji, Kamenyele Rasoko. But the most interesting name of all, Israel Folau, has been chosen by coach Steve Hansen. And apparently, they'll be flying the rainbow flag above the ground before the game kicks off. Now, you may remember Israel Folau ran into trouble with the Australian Rugby Union with his controversial views on homosexuality. So we'll see how that turns out over the weekend. Let's hope the focus is on the rugby and not on the politics. Have a great sporting weekend. We're back on Monday at 6:05 PNG time. I'm Richard Hewitt. Thanks for your company.